This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and our understanding. Charlene will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Jaina. I'm an alcoholic. The preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Matt will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Matt, and I'm an alcoholic. The steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Sheila, what were the traditions?
Hi, my name's Sheila. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sheila.
The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers. We will then take our information break, which is followed by the 30-minute main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is David A.
Hi, everyone. I'm David, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Firstly, I'd like to thank Duncan for asking me to speak tonight. It's always an honor and a privilege to speak before the Atlantic Group, which is my main home group. My other home group is PAX. My sobriety date is September 23, 2001. I have a sponsor whose name is Keith. You heard him speak here a couple of weeks ago. Keith has been sober for about 22 years. Keith has a sponsor named Tom, who's been sober for about 36 years. Tom has a sponsor named Jerry, who's been sober for about 46 years. I give that information to the newcomers in this room. I know there are a bunch of people in this room who are counting days. And when I first heard that kind of stuff, I didn't quite believe that you could stay sober that long. I actually didn't believe that you could survive this life without alcohol. But today I know that one day at a time you can go without alcohol for the rest of your life. But do it a day at a time. I started drinking alcoholically round about the age of 12 and 13. I came into the world of recovery at the age of 46. I was really, really sick. I was, I was killing myself with alcohol. And today I know that I'm standing here before you by the grace of God. And what I understand by that expression is that I receive God's grace. It's a gift that I get from God when I'm not asking for anything, when I'm not expecting anything, when I don't even really believe in God, but God gives me a gift. And it's it's very clear to me today that I managed to survive my drinking years by the grace of God. I did drop dead once, and I was revived in an emergency room, and after that engaged in my heaviest drinking. It was by the grace of God that some friends of mine told me that if I wanted them to remain my friends, I was going to have to do something about my problem, and one of them dragged me kicking and screaming to Hazleton, New York, a rehab in the city. And, it was by the grace of God that I picked up my feet and went there. And that institution told me that if I wanted to stay there, I had to work a 12-step program. I didn't really know what a 12-step program was. I picked up a big book once in my entire life and saw the word God scattered all over it and promptly put it down and said, this is not for me. I don't believe in God. So, I really thought they were kidding when they said I had to do that. I thought I was going in for some kind of, treatment, that I would learn to drink responsibly or get some magic cure for my problem. But they told me that I had a disease. They also told me that my disease was incurable. So, I was a little angry and upset. But mostly, the feeling I had the most was of sheer terror. I had been drinking since my youth, and I had been medicating my feelings with drugs and alcohol for close to 34 years. It was the only way that I knew how to deal with my feelings. I'm a typical alcoholic who just feels uncomfortable in my own skin. And when I put alcohol in my system, I felt much better. And that's what I did for a long, long time. And when it stopped working, I still carried on doing that because I didn't know any better. I didn't know what the alternatives were, and I was really too scared to think about them. The first step was an incredibly powerful message for me. I have a health problem, and basically, when I pick up a drink, I'm putting my life in danger. And I knew this. I really, really knew this. And I would wake up in the morning and say, I'm not going to do it. And 12 hours later, I was drunk. And I tried to stop many, many times, and I could not stop on my own. I really believed that doing things on my own was the only way to do it. So when I learned that I had a disease that I was powerless over, that was a really strong message for me, and it was a great explanation as to why I was doing what I'd done. I also learned that in the first step that there's a dash in the middle of the step. It doesn't say that my life was unmanageable because I was drinking too much. It says that my life had become unmanageable. What I learned was that I suffer from a disease called alcoholism, and it's that disease that makes my life unmanageable if I don't treat it. And I was treating it with alcohol, so now I'm being told to put down the alcohol, and I'm in big trouble because I need to replace it. So to say I was scared is an understatement. I really was terrified. But still, it was, there was some relief at having this explanation as to my behavior. And I then got to the second step, and I told my counselor that I'm not doing it because I don't believe in God. I had a fundamental concept of God. I believed that He created the universe, and then He split. He wasn't in my life. He wasn't in your life. And I had plenty of proof of that. And my counselor knew my story, and he said to me, well, how many times did you try to stop on your own? And I said, several hundred, maybe approximating 1,000 over the years. He said, how did that go? I said, well, I'm sitting in rehab, aren't I? It was a total failure. He said, well, can you admit that you can't get sober on your own? I said, yes. He said, well, you've just done the second step. And, I used the AA group as my higher power for a while. And, today I know that God is in my life. I know that God has taken care of me to bring me here today. And I have faith that God is going to take care of me in the future. Most of the time, not all of the time. I still can very quickly go to a place of fear. But today, I have tools to get me out of it. I told you I have a sponsor. When I got into rehab, they told me to get a sponsor. And I was really so, I was reluctant to do anything, but I was so beaten up. I had that little gift of willingness. And I met a guy at my very first AA meeting, and he was a gay Muslim alcoholic with no drugs in his story, and I'm a straight Jewish alcoholic with a lot of drugs in my story. I said, this is never going to work, but I'm going to appease my counselors and ask him to be my sponsor. 4.5 years later, he said to me, I've got some personal issues. Please find a new sponsor. And I very reluctantly broke that relationship. I tell that story again for the newcomer. There are a lot of great people in this room who've worked the program. If they don't look or talk or act like you, don't worry. Judge them by how they work the program, not on their appearance and their history. I never like to say that I'm grateful that I'm an alcoholic. I think that pays disservice to the deadly nature of this disease. But I do like to say that I'm incredibly grateful for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It saved my life, And it's done the same for millions of people around the world. It is so much easier to work this program and all that entails than to be an active alcoholic. It is hundreds of times easier. And it has changed my life for the better. And today I lead a blessed life. And thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Jackie T.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jackie, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Thank you, Jen, for asking me to speak. It's an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak at any Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and especially at my home group. And also welcome to the people that are here that are new. This is an open meeting. And also welcome to the people that are here from Al-Anon also that are just checking us out. Because that's how I got started. I came in through these rooms through Al-Anon. And my path got me into Al-Anon, and I was invited to go to some open AA meetings, and I was living in Los Angeles at the time. And I went to my first open AA meeting. I was back within a month, and it was the Pacific Group. And there were 1,000 people that go every Wednesday night, and it was just so overwhelming. And in the beginning, I didn't think I had a problem drinking, you know, and I was going to the meetings, you know, having drank and just feeling really, really uncomfortable because I was starting to hear my story. And I also heard things about the disease of alcoholism, how it's such a progressive disease, and the not yets, you know, where people would be up here at the podium talking and then where I was at that point, and then 10 years later, the not yets. So I was hearing stuff, you know, the seed had been planted. In the meantime, I continued my Al-Anon, and eventually I was in a relationship, and that ended, and I come back to New York, and I realized that I don't have a choice today. I can't drink. I can't wake up every morning and go, well, am I going to drink or am I not going to drink? No, that choice has been taken away from me. What I do have a choice today is to wake up and get on my knees and say, thank you, God, here's another day that I'm abstinent and that I'm sober. And then how can I be of service, and how can I carry your will today? Because on my own, no. I was selfish, arrogant, self-righteous. I always wanted my own way. But now it's like, God, what can I do to be of service to you? How can I find your will? So a little bit of history here. So my first drink was when I was in high school. And I was out with the boys, and I'm in the van with the shag carpeting and the 8-track tape, and we went to a bar, and the people that are laughing are probably around my age that understand about 8-tracks. My first drink was Southern Comfort. We're doing shots of Southern Comfort and chasing it with the beer. Before I know, I don't know how much I drank. My head is hanging out the window, and I'm throwing up. So that's where my drink always took me, you know, to excess. I didn't know how to stop. And then through college, also drinking and, you know, continuing through the 80s and stuff. And I got hooked up with a man back, I guess, when I was like 19. And I was always so uncomfortable in my skin. And I was full of fear. I was full of anger. My parents moved out of the city, you know, for a better life. I mean, I loved growing up here in New York. I was taken away. And, you know, here I was at 13, 14 with my first resentment against my mom. You know, I just hated it. I mean, she's trying to make a better life with my dad for us kids, but I was miserable. And then I really, really started to act out with alcohol and other substances. So, you know, my life continues. I'm away at college. I meet up this man. I'm working in a hospital. He's my patient. And he asked me to go to Europe and take care of him. And I'm off in Europe. And here I am, marrying him, like it. A little bit later, you know, no thought to it. 2 years later, his sister comes to visit me and says, oh, you know, can't wait for you and my brother to get married. I go, we're already married. He goes, Jackie, no, you're not. He's still married. So I'm like, oh, my marriage was a scam. My life was a scam. But I still stayed with him for another 2 years. But this is my thinking. And today it's such a program of rigorous honesty that, you know, this is not the way I behave today. You know, I've always hooked up with men that, you know, either did more alcohol than I did because I never wanted anybody to tell me what to do. And then, you know, then it comes fast forward later on to having a marriage. Now, there was something in me that said intuitively, you know, there's that little God voice in there that I always chose to ignore. I knew I shouldn't have been marrying this man. So the day I'm up at Martha's Vineyard and I'm trying to get out of this marriage. And that morning I tried to go skinny dipping and get arrested, you know, so I didn't have to go through the wedding. I mean, but this was such normal thinking for me. You know, I never gave things a second thought. You know, the marriage happens 2 years later, you know, of course it's going to end in divorce. Now I take off here in the city. I'm back in Manhattan. You know, I'm out at the bars. I'm up and down Columbus Avenue. You know, my girlfriends would want to go home at, you know, midnight, 1 o'clock. And I'm like, wait, the bar's still open till 4. What are you talking about? You know, and then to the after hours clubs, it was always more, more, more. If I had a drink in my hand, I wasn't enjoying this drink. I was looking over for the next drink, the next drink. So, you know, here I am, you know, I'm fast forwarding, the marriage ends. I'm out in Los Angeles with another man, another relationship who I, you know, meet in April, and by September I'm out living with him. At one point, I crossed this invisible line. The alcohol stopped working. I don't know when it happened. But around 97, I was like, okay, now I need something else. I go to have elective bunion surgery just so I can get these painkillers, Vicodin. So for 3 weeks, I'm going to drink and have these pills. Now, you know, insanity. You know, that was me. And I just wanted to drink. And then eventually, you know, yes, we're here in AA, but, you know, these pills and this stuff has been such a part of my story, because even though I stopped drinking on July 4th of 01, because I was trying to control my drinking, and I thought, well, I couldn't really drink every day and, you know, try to function, so I'll, you know, be on these pills that I got from a psychiatrist, you know, prescribed, that I abused, but, you know, that's another story. And it turned out that I kept doing these pills and drinking. And then I come eventually to the Atlanta group, because I knew deep in my head that, wow, the Pacific group, the Atlanta group. I walk in. I run into Stephanie. I ask her to be my sponsor. She doesn't want to have anything to do with me. She is scared of me. She's like, hell no. So she goes and talks to Ava, and Ava says, no, you have to. Thank God she did. Because she guided me through the steps, and I'm just so blessed today. Today I have Lori as my sponsor, and, you know, I do what I'm taught today. You know, make the phone calls every day, you know, sponsor other women, do service, go to Rikers, you know, chair a meeting, put away the, chairs, anything. A little plug for hospitality. I hated going out for fellowship. Hated it. I was so uncomfortable in my own skin, so uncomfortable around you guys for the first couple of years. You know, I'm now with hospitality. So thank you for the commitment, Bob. And tonight, Jeans, please. That's going to be our place from now on. So a plug for Jeans and for hospitality. And please come out, because I was so uncomfortable. Tell me how you're feeling, you know, and I'll get you through it, because I was there and I could share my experience today. Just what happened, you know, I stopped the alcohol, but, you know, I was still on these pills. And, you know, I speak about this today because there were so many people dying. And when I spoke to Ava about it, you know, even though I wasn't drinking, that was like the hard substance, because I couldn't be around drinking every day anymore. So I took these pills, and then to a point where I 12-step a guy and he wound up 12-stepping me. And that night it was like I was done. I couldn't be on these pills anymore. And I called Stephanie and I found a doctor and I detoxed. So I wound up changing my sobriety date to June 21st, 2002. And that's how I got honest. And Peggy, when I shared one night on Thursday, she goes, Jackie, you probably saved somebody's life. Because for me, if I didn't get honest and I held on to these secrets for so long, I would probably drink again and drink. And I don't know if I would be back here, because I could be out there. And Van was my sponsor at one time. And he was one of the founders of Peggy, of the Atlanta group. And he showed me a man. He was with dignity and grace. You know, many times I don't want to show up and I maybe don't want to do things, but he came here with oxygen masks, and it would take him 20 minutes just to walk from the corner in here. And he showed me how to behave. And I'm so blessed to have that man in my life. Thanks, Van. And also, I got to thank my mom for always coming to my anniversaries. I always forget to thank her. So, Mom, thank you for coming. I'm thanking her tonight. Cool. 1 minute. Look at all these people here, and it's snowing today. Anyway, a lot of people have been in here to help me. Two women specifically this past year, Gina and Julie,
They have really upped my sobriety and my abstinence. I really feel closer to God today, a God of my understanding that's amazing. Like David said, you know, the rooms were my God. Nature was my God. But now God is just unbelievable. I'm just feeling such a strength and a peace and serenity today that's beyond my wildest dreams. I have so many people to thank in here. And Alcoholics Anonymous and Bill W. and Bob, because, wow, you know, go to Akron. You know, we were there this year. It totally rocks. Bill Wilson House. I can't speak enough for the Atlanta group and the fellowship and just for everything that I've been given and the steps, sponsorship. I got my goodbye. Thank you, everybody.
Our main speaker tonight is Hal.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Hal. And was chatting on the phone today with Bob, and I told him the story of when I first got sober. I had gotten my 90 days, and I was asked to speak, and this was at Fast Break, which was one of the two meetings I went to very consistently when I first got sober. And I was so nervous, like I'm feeling now. And I was walking down very early in the morning to speak, and there was a young woman who had moved to New York just when I started getting sober. And I ran into her. She was an actress. She was very pretty. She was petite. And I called her the Angel of California because she was so attentive and helpful to me. And I saw her and I said, oh, I'm so nervous. I'm about to speak. And, first time. And she sort of smiled and she leaned up because she was very small and she whispered in my ear, tell the truth. And that has been any time I have the privilege to get to share my experience, strength and hope with my fellow alcoholics, you know, like the most important thing for me to remember. That's really all I've got is my story. And you know, I'm definitely nervous. I am a little overwhelmed, a little scared. And yet, you know, I know that about myself. You know, that's the blessing for me. You know, I have an emotional illness that I call alcoholism. And I learned here that the way I related to ethyl alcohol was a symptom of that illness. You know, early on in my recovery, I found something in the Big Book that helped me tremendously. It's been a real guide for me, and it's probably what's kept me coming back more than any other thing. And it's from the story, He Who Loses His Life. In the Big Book, and the author quotes Edna St. Vincent Millay in our Big Book, and she says, pity me the heart that is slow to learn what the quick mind sees at every turn. And that really had deep resonance for me early on, coming to terms with what I was dealing with, who I was dealing with, you know, what it was about me that got me where I was. And he goes on to say, I'll just read this one thing, he says, for a long time, we can endure the intellects being ahead of the emotions, which is the import of Millay's couplet. But as the years go by, the stretch becomes unbearable. And the man with the grown-up brain and the childish emotions, vanity, self-interest, false pride, jealousy, longing for social approval, to name a few, becomes a prime candidate for alcohol. And then this was the sentence that has meant so much to me. He said, to my way of thinking, that is a definition of alcoholism, a state of being in which the emotions have failed to grow to the stature of the intellect. That's what I've been dealing with by the grace of God and with your help for 18 years. I will be, God willing, 50 years old this year. I have a graduate education from an Ivy League university, and I went through a breakup about 3 years ago, and I'm telling you, I can promise you, there are 13-year-old you know, cheerleaders in Topeka, Kansas, who could have helped me deal with that better than I did. You know, that's who's talking to you tonight. You know, I have got, you know, the struggle I have had, you know, coming to terms with my emotional life. And, you know, the fix for that condition, which the language of the big book speaks to over and over and over. The two words in the fifth step in the 12 and 12, anxious apartness. You know, did two words ever capture more clearly my life experience from age 5 to 17? You know, that was the condition. And finding booze, you know, was the first relief to that condition. My first drink was at age 13. That first drink became my first drunk. The word drink was always a verb, never a noun in my experience. An active experience. It was not something that you just did. I remember being 3 years sober and reading an article in the New York Times on alcoholic poisoning and on college campuses. 3 years sober. And the reporter made reference or quoted a specialist in drug addiction, alcohol abuse, saying that that more than 5 drinks in one sitting was considered like problem drinking. I was 3 years sober, and I looked up from where I was sitting. I said, 5? You know, like I was just 5 for like weeks. I walked around 5. You know, like, you know, it was like mind numbing to me. You know, to start to get a perspective on where my behavior had taken me. Also around the age of 13, my mother and my aunt and my two sisters all went together to Tiger Stadium in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where I grew up, to hear Billy Graham. And I remember it vividly. And if any of, you know, this, we're in a Methodist church, and Flannery O'Connor called, you know, I'm Southern, and she called it the Christ-haunted South. You know, it's like very rich in that sort of gothic. I grew up about 2 miles from Jimmy Swaggart Ministries. So this was the impact. You know, it's like a world where things aren't so much good and bad as good and evil. You know, so there was just a lot of this very gothic guilt and shame that I was very predisposed to. But I remember going to hear him. And at the end of his service, he calls people down as part of the Christian experience. And I went, and I have joked years later saying, you know, he could have been selling handguns and I'd have gone down there. You know, it was just to get away from my mother and my sisters and my aunt, because, you know, there was, and I remember that experience, and I don't mean to be flippant about that. I think something spiritual did happen for me. And, you know, in my adolescence, I did start to prize that part of my nature that I was tapping into. In fact, when I was a couple of years sober, I remember going home to my parents' house at the time where they were living, and my room was still sort of like a shrine to my childhood or something, and on the wall was the Serenity Prayer, and I didn't even know that I had put it there. So that was very touching to me. But, you know, I had a few other experiences in early adolescence of drinking and getting drunk, and that incredible relief, but I think because of that spiritual experience, I stopped. And, you know, that anxious apartness, that loneliness, really was just a the way of life for me. And then in college, I had the experience of sort of really getting to tap into that big shotism. You know, I became president of my fraternity. All that was so important to me, you know, being, you know, the appeasing that emotional insecurity. And then, you know, when college ended, I was just dumbfounded. Like, you know, why are we leaving here? You know, it was like, if they hadn't kicked me out of that fraternity house, I'd still be there. You know, that's like, you know, the truth of my experience. And everybody started getting married, and, you know, I was like, I don't get it. You know, it was just not making sense to me. And it was right out of college that I started drinking again. And then I moved to New York at age 25. So in those few years out of school, I'd started to drink, and I came to New York when I was 25 years old. And, you know, all I can say is, you know, I remember just being free of the driver's license. You know, I'd had a lot of bad car experiences. I never had a DWI, but I was certainly on my way toward one. And, you know, New York threw it into fifth gear for me.
I remember at the Lincoln Center there was a bus stop, and it wasn't even an advertisement so much. I don't know what it was, like a PSA or something, but it simply said, invisibility is your revenge. And that was like my mantra. You know, I could, you know, just sort of disappear and roam the city and, you know, and drink. And I dolled it up real nice. I came to go to graduate school, and I did embark on that, and I got three quarters of the way through, had been totally unrealistic about money, especially as an active alcoholic. I've told this story before, but it's kind of a signature of my active alcoholism. In those drinking years between age 25 and 31 when I came into AA, there was an actual experience where I gathered all my bills together. I had a bottle of red wine. I got some colored pens, and I wrote relax on all my bills and mailed them in. You know, and, you know, took care of that, you know, done. And yeah, and I get these calls, you know, Mr. Strickland, you know, what is relax, you know, and, you know, but again, it was that, you know, it was just the grand, you know, a principal factor of that emotional illness for me was grandiosity. You know, it was first defined by, don't you know who I am? You know, this president of my fraternity. And then, of course, you know, moving here where, you know, who cares? You know, and then just slowly dissipating. And I'm a big believer, the only thing worse than don't you know who I am is don't you know who I was? And, you know, that sort of like became the condition. But, you know, the money part, you know, I where like on the credit card bills where it says credit limit, my mind drunk would read, you have just won. You know, and that was my experience of it. And of course, that took me to horrible places, you know, financially and emotionally and spiritually. And, I dropped out of the graduate program, which was a horrible source of shame, for me. And I think the shame was starting to metastasize. And I took a job in a restaurant, For 3 years, I worked there, a very nice restaurant, about two blocks from my house. That was getting my life very small. And I became a really surly waiter. That's, I think, the best way to put it. You know, it's like just very ugly with people. And, you know, and would drink on the job and could get away with it. And, you know, and then, too, just always sort of chasing that phantom relationship that was going to change everything for me. That's person outside of me that would make me whole. You know, that was that thing outside of me, that thing I was looking for. And, you know, that evolved into a messy relationship which ended. And something in that, you know, there's that line in the eighth step too where it says defective relations with other human beings. Was, you know, with defective relations with other human beings was the very cause of our alcoholism. So, you know, it speaks to that aspect too. And something happened there, you know, that was part of the change for me. You know, growing up in the South, being, you know, having my background, there was a line from the Psalms that kind of came in really clearly for me. And it says very simply, my spirit fainted within me. And I knew that's what had happened to me. This was September of 1989, and I was in trouble, and I knew it. And not even, you know, I could still keep sending in ridiculous things to credit card companies. I could still get by with work, but something inside had happened to me, and I knew it. And it scared me really badly. And, you know, I remember finding this book of, I had a collection of Martin Luther King sermons, and I started reading them. And a woman at my workplace, who I think God sent, you know, saw me reading it and sort of opened up to her a little bit. And I went with her to like a little Christian service in her house. And it, you know, I was trying, but it wasn't quite clicking for me. You know, and I remember I kept waiting for one of my best friends from home to come up. And I thought, if I can talk to him, I'll get better. You know, that he can help me with this. And they came and they left. And I remember we went to some grand restaurant and all we were doing was talking all this surface stuff. And I had promised this woman I would go to her, a gathering up in, like near Albany of this Christian group. But I didn't realize that I would go get drunk the night before, you know, we were supposed to go. So I got in like at 4 o'clock, met them to get on a bus at 6 o'clock to ride up to this thing in Albany. And everybody is clapping and singing, and I am like, I am going to, you know, shoot somebody here. That's what I'll do. You know, and we got up there, and I remember, this is so funny, I think, what gets our attention. You know, C.S. Lewis said, pain is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. And I think he uses that to get our attention. And I went to out to the service, and I could not sit still for it. And I walked across the way, the street, to this empty shopping center that was completely abandoned. And I saw in this abandoned shopping center a reflection of myself. And I had a moment there where I said, there was a woman friend of mine who I should mention who had gotten sober in AA who annoyed me beyond words. She'd be in the cab with her and she'd tell, I'd go, guess what? I'm sober in AA. And I'm like, you cannot be doing this. I was like, so horrified. And, but she kept trying to get me to go to meetings too. So thank you. And she, I agreed, sitting there in that empty parking lot of that abandoned shopping mall in Albany, New York, I said, I'm going to go to an AA meeting tomorrow. I'm going to do that. She had kept pointing me in different directions. And that next day was November 5th, 1989, and I walked from my apartment on the 71st Street down to Fireside at the West Side Y. And that was my first meeting. And oh, you know, I was so moved. I'm so glad I got to speak after all, everybody was sharing their day count. You know, because it just still moves me so much. I heard 11 days. I heard 25 days. I heard 64 days. You know, one after another. And just, you know, every single one of you, you are without doubt the most important people here. I think all of us could vouch for that. You know, and each day right now is just beyond heroic. You know, and so just getting yourself here, it's hard. It's hard to do this. You know, it's hard to let go, you know, and I think to change. I mean, I've joked that whole first year sober, I could have, like, taped the back of my palm to my forehead, you know, and just marched around town. You know, just the self-pity was just oozing, you know, so incredibly. You know, I remember I legitimately had the thought, you know, the government should pay me for this, you know. That was my, you know, the way I sort of rationalized it. But, you know, I showed up there and, you know, for the first 5, 6, 7 days, I didn't say a word. I didn't say a word to anyone. A friend of the woman who had been trying to get me to come to AA spoke at my very first meeting. And you know what? I thought he was cool. So that got me to my second meeting. You know, it was that, the way that worked. But I didn't say a word. And then the night, and I didn't say a word to anybody, I don't think I even told her I had gone. I was keeping it totally to myself because I wasn't really going to do this, you know. And when I had 6 days, that night, I had a dream. And in that dream, a woman from my high school, Gracie H, I'll call her, you know, what Gracie was her name, who had been a dear, dear connection for me. In this dream, she descended this beautiful stairwell, and she was lit from behind, and it was huge smile on her face, and she said these words to me. She said, have you confessed this? A big smile. And I said, what? Big smile again, lit even more from the back. And she said, have you confessed this? And I said, what? And big smile. And she said one more time, have you confessed this? And I said, what? And woke up. And I sat down and I, you know, with what spiritual reference I had, I went to my Bible and I looked up the word confession in the back and I got reference to a verse that said, confess your sins to one another. And I looked up from the book and I said, I have to say I'm an alcoholic. And that was my moment of clarity. That was my first step. That was the start. And I marched down that day to Fireside, day 7, and I raised my hand and said I was an alcoholic. And you know, the way this process works, the way the steps work, just a source of absolute fascination to me. You know, the word we admitted, first step, we admitted, fifth step, we admitted, tenth step, we admitted. And it's really physics. You know, the minute we admit it, we're admitted. You know, the way that works. And that's what happened for me. You know, I started, you know, my second day there, there was a celebrity there, a big celebrity. So, remember my grandiosity? So I thought, oh, I'll get him to sponsor me. You know, I'll let him, you know, was pretty much the attitude. well, you know, God was looking after him. I didn't see him again for like a year. So, you know, he saved himself from seeing, from that approach. But there was a guy there who was really not like me at all. Real tough guy. I found out later he'd been in prison. 2 years younger than me. And he was about 3 years sober. And about 50 days, so it was right at November 5th, right around Christmas. Things got a little hairy around family. And I decided to ask him to sponsor me, and he did, Todd C. And he sponsored me that next 3 years. And what a blessing. You know, the way sponsorship works, I've had three sponsors in my year sober, Todd C., Jim H., and Lonnie M., and they've each given me incredible gifts. And I've had the privilege of sponsoring other people, too. But Todd was an incredible help, and I just dug into meetings. You know, that's what I did. And I will tell you, especially for everyone who's new, you know, I was so unhappy. You know, I just, first of all, I really did, was beset by the thought, I can never drink again. You know, this felt like an unimaginable curse to me. 31 years old, and I can never drink again. I could not even begin to see that that could be a good thing, you know, nowhere near. But I kept coming. You know, it was just, it was a horrible, horrible curse in my mind. And I kept coming, and when I got to 90 days, which happened to be Groundhog Day, November 5th to February 2nd, and I remember that for some reason. And I remember going down to the meeting, and I celebrated my 90 days, and by this time, I'd started to make a few connections and with people. And I remember sitting in the room afterwards, and I was still really miserable. And I share that for anyone who's new, you know, that that was a condition that lasted a while. I didn't, you know, I was getting some relief, but I wasn't happy about this. And if you're not, it's okay. You don't have to be, but you can show up. You know, in that first 90 days, what was the complete source of fascination to me was the meeting started on time. You know, that's what I go, let me just go down there and see if they'll start it on time again. I was so fascinated by this, you know, and yet that little principle, practicing our principles, guess what I do now? You know, working and being successful and all the gifts that have come. I show up and I'm on time, you know, and it was like that was the first little seed of like, okay, this is how you live. This is what you do to live a decent life. But at 90 days, I remember having the very clear thought, you know what, Hal? This is still a curse. The government still should pay you to do this. You know, all of that insanity. I said, but you know what? I could finally face, I was better off that day, that Groundhog Day, than I would have been otherwise. And I knew it. I knew that was true. And I think I was on my way there. So, in my first 90 days, I heard a qualification that had a tremendous impact on me. It was a man named Dennis. It was somewhere in those like 53, 54 days. And he said two things that I've never forgotten. And they were sort of keepers for me. He spoke of this disease as a state of, he spoke of it as possessing a malignant sense of entitlement. And I've never forgotten that phrase. You know, what you're supposed to be doing for me to make me okay. You know, a complete abstracted framework to deal with life, but believing it. And he spoke of this condition as one of malignant narcissism. You know, I think our language is a little more gentler with it. You know, self-centered in the extreme. You know, those things. You know, what did the alcoholic say when he dropped the priceless vase at the Metropolitan? I'm okay. You know, you know, but you know, just how we see ourselves at that center. You know, completely at that center. And to me, this is where, you know, the steps have been transformative. You know, the journey in Alcoholics Anonymous for me has really been through the path offered by the steps. And they, you know, are so astounding to me. And the thing that I see that means so much to me in the steps is in the first step, we admitted we were powerless. And, you know, 18 plus years sober by the grace of God and through your help. I don't, to this day, there's a part of me that doesn't like that about myself, but you know what? I love knowing it. I love knowing it. The gift of being in touch with that truth about myself has just been a catalyst for so many other things. Because it's that self-awareness that has helped me to evolve as a human being. So the steps became key. I think that first step, which is demonstrated every time we go to a meeting, my experience with simply stating I was an alcoholic and what that meant. And my third step became, in coming to believe, showing up, you know, we came to believe, that little cliche. And, you know, then the third step really became that reconnection with that spirit for me. You know, really starting the process of turning my will in my life, our will in our lives, you know, over, and so, so, so importantly to me here. And I think this was so crucial to me really starting to separate what was belief in God from having a higher power. They're two very different things for me, but making that very real and sort of alive in me. And the what did is, and I think this is where these steps are such genius, you know, it really did become the understanding what I'm turning my will and my life over to,
thank you,
is the care of God. You know, and that is so important, that distinction. And, you know, I love words and their meaning. That's what I studied. I will say, sober, I went back and got that graduate degree I had left, which meant a lot to me. And, you know, the care and the words. And if you look at the word care, its etymology is from the Latin, meaning to lament with. So I'm turning my will and my life over to the care of God, like for His care for me, that these are things, you know, that I can trust. You know, I think it was really starting to see, and I didn't talk much about this, but, you know, my abuse in childhood, all the things that, you know, that sense of being victimized, all of those things that seem to justify erroneously, but nonetheless, that malignant sense of entitlement, were not happening to me, but were happening for me. And that was the transformative piece for me. You know, that the gift of my alcoholism in that way, what it was designed to do to help me spiritually. And I think that's what's freed me. You know, I'll say this. This was a major discovery for me in my recovery about myself. And I was sober about 5-6 years, and I mentioned that emotional illness. And I had a moment sitting in a meeting. This happened a few times. It was right before my 6th anniversary. And I was sitting in a meeting, and every now and then this happens. My therapist calls it hypnagogic reverie. But, you know, I'm not schizophrenic, I don't think. But I would hear this little voice. And the voice said to me these words, "You can feel it all." And I was 6 years sober. But what does that mean? You know, when I was 90 days sober, I had immediately found some therapy, and I was in such a state, and I was saying to the therapist at the time, I said, you know, I miss talking about the booze in my head. And he said, "The euphoria?" And I wanted to kill him. You know, how dare you? You know, that I was so dependent on a constant state of euphoria and couldn't, and needed to open up to the fullness of an emotional life. And, you know, that's what that little voice came to be. And I can tell you, 18 years sober, you know, when I was early sober, I'd hear someone had gone out at 20 years or something. I'd say, that doesn't make any sense. They must have stopped going to meetings. I'd have that thought. I get it. You know, as human beings, I mean, I 12 years sober, I hit right after September 11th some grief that if I hadn't had every minute of my recovery, I don't know if I could have experienced. But guess what? I felt it. You know, and I grew from it. And the big discovery I was going to mention for me was this, and that is I realized that all of the suffering I ever experience, all of the pain for me, is always the same. It's in the tension between what is and what I think it should be. And my ego will always tell me that the solution is in what I think it should be. And I've learned in AA that the solution is also available in the surrender to what is. Now, on the surface, that's not enough. If I don't have a third step to bring that to, it's no deal. But if I can start to trust that in that state of what is, and that the steps can facilitate that, there's balm for the suffering and even something better for me. And that's what that care is. And that's been my experience. You know, for anyone who's new, you know, everything in these last, the years before, you know, that getting sober and the years since that I thought I wanted, you know, thank God I didn't get it. You know, so I've just been given the 1 minute. And just to close, I was thinking, I wanted to share this. You know, I love words, their meaning, and I just wanted to close with a little poem. It's just very short. It's one, Robert Frost, one stanza. But it meant a lot to me. And I think it's so important, it's been so important to me for as an alcoholic, to start just treasuring my life. You know, I started off this meeting feeling a little nervous, a little overwhelmed. But you know, I'm so grateful to Bob asking me to speak. So grateful to be here and, you know, this renowned meeting and the privilege of getting to speak, like both of my fellow speakers said. But this little poem of Robert Frost I love, it's one stanza, four lines, and it's called A Question. And he says, a voice said, look me in the stars and tell me truly, men of earth, if all the soul and body scars were not too much to pay for birth. I'm so thankful for the chance to speak. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.